Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's jump right into our week in review, beginning with the fight in the U.S. House of Representatives over Democratic leadership. In one corner, Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton.
The clear call right now is for new leadership. That's what the Democratic people want. That's what the American people want. And we shouldn't fail to answer that call.
And in the other corner, Nancy Pelosi, who says she'll be Speaker of the House no matter what Seth Moulton says.
I have overwhelming support in my caucus to be Speaker of the House. I happen to think that at this point, I'm the best person for that.
And so far sitting this out, Congresswoman-elect Ayanna Pressley, who said this to CNN.
I'm uncommitted, but I do want to say this. There's no zero-sum game in any of this. I have deep respect and admiration for Leader Pelosi.
So what does this infighting mean for the Democratic Party as it prepares to take control of the House? We'll talk about that and some other big local stories that we've tracked this week. With me in the studio right now is Reverend Miriamma White Hammond. She's pastor at the New Roots Church in Dorchester. And thanks so much for coming in, Miriamma. Good to have
you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Joe Battenfeld. He's a political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Hello to you, Joe.
Hello, Anthony.
And happy Friday to you both. So let's start with this contest among the Democrats. They don't have a person opposing Nancy Pelosi. This is Seth Moulton and the folks who want her not to be Speaker. What's this about? Let me start with you, Joe.
They need somebody as the face of the movement. They should decide. They probably should have decided earlier on who they have come up with. There is one Congresswoman, Marcia Fudge, I believe her name is.
Right, from Ohio.
Who's emerged. But, Moulton is playing a bit of a dangerous game here. If he doesn't have enough support, look for him to be, showing up in the basement of the Capitol any day now. It's not kind to, Pelosi is not going to be kind to Moulton, who's trying to overthrow her, if he indeed is not successful. So I think, while I agree with Moulton that Democrats need new blood, I think it's interesting that she seems to be shoring up her support.
Yeah. Miriamma, is this a good fight for Democrats to be having right now?
Well, I'm not sure it's the best fight to be having publicly, but here's what I do think. I think that, what success Democrats have seen recently is because voters think that Trump is so bad. That's not really a good enough reason to win. You don't want to just win because your opponent is considered, so bad. And I think the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't really have a positive vision that it's running on. There are some bright lights within the party in terms of people who I think have been able to mobilize people for positive reasons. But overwhelmingly, I do think what success they're having is possibly a negative backlash, not possibly, probably mostly a negative backlash against Trump. Mm. So I think that in terms of Moulton raising this question, I do think there is some validity to the reality that at some point you have to put out a positive message of what you're for, not just what you're against. I'm not so hopeful about where the Democrats are in that.
Interesting. Joe, what do you think about that? Because you could argue, on the other hand, a lot of Democrats ran on issues like health care, for example.
Right. And Pelosi has been a big champion of the Affordable Care Act. But on the other hand, I think that it's not good overall for Democrats to be having this leadership fight right now, because I think Pressley made a good point today on Twitter when she said nobody in her district is talking about the fight to become Speaker. They're all talking about issues like housing, the environment, health care. So I think that, right now Democrats should get back to talking about what issues they're going to be emphasizing, and it would be good of them to dispose of the leadership fight as soon as possible.
I think that's a great point. And Miriamma, I sort of bring it up. I'm glad Joe brought it up, even though I sort of second the idea of it being a good point, even at my own peril, because here we are leading the show with this issue. But maybe this isn't an issue that most voters out there really care about.
So I actually agree. I think that who leads the party is in many people's mind in minutia.
Yeah.
The problem is I do think there's a direction issue at the party in general. And some would argue that Nancy Pelosi has had more than enough chance to demonstrate she could lead the party in a new direction, and she hasn't. So I think the question of there's a question of whether or not people in America care who the speaker is or is not. But I do think that there's a deeper problem that Democrats have to address about who they are and where they're going, and the question of whether or not they need new blood to help them get clear on that.
So yesterday on the show, we heard from Democratic strategist Scott Fersen. He was a senior advisor during Congressman Seth Moulton's 2014 campaign. Here's what he said about the Democrats sort of struggling around this issue right now.
I think the optics of, frankly, removing the female leader while the two other people in leadership who are both 78 and 79 years old and both happen to be male, I'm not sure we need this fight right now.
Yeah.
I would think, you know, just given the age of the leadership, putting Seth's efforts into bringing up that younger class of leadership, a lot of whom were elected on last Tuesday, I thought would have been better well spent.
Right. So, Joe, I mean, again, the idea of maybe not the greatest fight to have right now.
Yeah, interesting. Moulton doesn't seem to be taking the advice of his advisor to heart, but... But no, I agree that it's not good for Democrats to be having this fight right now. But on the other hand, they need a change at the top. They definitely need a change. They need a change, and not just Democrats, but Republicans too. The voters are clamoring for change. The voters are clamoring for a new direction for Congress and to get things done. And I think that keeping the speaker would be symbolic of no change at all.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't know if I'm sure you both saw the latest cover of The New Yorker, which is just this wonderful picture of the sort of old Congress, lots of white men written and drawn in pencil. And the door is opening and there's Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and some other folks of color, the Muslim woman who was elected to Congress for the first time, bursting into this room. So change is happening, whether or not there is change at the top, don't you think?
Right. And I think, I mean, I guess the question is it going to be managed change or is it going to be, you know, sort of a sea change? And I think, you know, the jury is out on that. I think nothing changes necessarily in one election cycle. This change is reflecting a change in the country. But I do think, whether it is in public or not, whether it's about the speaker or not, I do think that Democrats are long overdue for a tough conversation about where they need to go. And I think the same is true for the Republican Party. And I think the younger generation that is getting more excited and more engaged is going to push that conversation whether people are ready to have it or not.
All right. Well, I think that can only be a good thing. So I want to move on and ask about one more story from the Capitol before we move on to other topics closer to home. Jim Acosta of CNN against the White House. Last week, during a contentious press conference at the White House following the midterm elections, Acosta confronted Trump, asking why he insisted on calling the migrant caravan an invasion, and then pushed for several follow-up questions until things went from bad to worst.
If I may ask one other question, Mr. President, if I may ask one other question, are you worried?
That's enough. That's enough.
Mr. President, I was going to ask one of the other folks.
That's enough.
Pardon me, ma'am. Mr. President.
That's enough.
That's enough. So the White House revoked Acosta's press credentials. Just today, a federal judge granted an emergency motion to restore Acosta's credential, a ruling that the Trump administration, he ruled that the Trump administration had most likely violated Acosta's due process rights. So here's Acosta today outside federal court in Washington.
I want to thank all of my colleagues in the press who supported us this week. And I want to thank the judge for the decision he made today. And let's go back to work.
By the way, that judge was appointed by President Trump. Mariama, is this a big win for freedom of the press? How do you see this?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, I'm glad that ultimately the courts have functioned as they should. And but I think, to be honest with you, my view of the White House press situation is that it has devolved into a place that I'm really not sure that this is a win. I think there's a whole much larger context of what's going on there that just feels to me the only word I can use is just hot mess. That's what it just seems like.
And hot mess because of the sort of spectacle that is created by this, I don't know, the press versus the president.
At the point that you have, you know, the White House press room is one of the biggest jokes on Saturday Night Live. And right. I mean, it's just devolved into a place where truths and facts and, you know, getting a straight answer. I mean, it just feels like I'm not sure if that's where the focus should be. And it just feels like it's not there.
It feels like too many of the reporters down there are showboating rather than doing their jobs. And Acosta is right at the top of that list as I would include. You know, I don't think he's a great face of the First Amendment, but I do agree that, you know, Trump was stupid to take away his credentials because it just elevated him into a hero. But and by the way, I don't think this ruling is a big victory for freedom of the press, because in fact the ruling was very limited. It didn't touch on the First Amendment at all. The judge made the ruling based on the Fifth Amendment, saying that they didn't give Acosta enough warning or due process before taking away his credentials. So, it's unclear whether it would survive a First Amendment challenge or not. But I just think this is another issue where the people of this country, you know, it is a spectacle down there. And I don't think the people really are interested in seeing, you know, a bunch of self-aggrandizing reporters fight amongst themselves. They do want to get answers to questions. But, you know, this is not the way to go about it.
I kind of agree. I mean, it's interesting. You know, as a fellow journalist, I'm concerned if the White House steps in and tries to revoke someone's press credential. On the other hand, I can't help imagining how CNN delights in the idea of one of their reporters poking the bear, nudging up those ratings. You know, everybody knows that people tune in when a reporter kind of confronts Trump that way. And I'm not sure that that's the journalism that should be going on down there. So I find myself sort of in the middle of this one, too, and thinking, on the one hand, this, on the other hand, wasn't completely comfortable with that confrontation. I mean, ask the question, but you don't have to make a political pronouncement and sort of poke the bear, because you're just going to be playing Trump's game, I guess.
And you rarely get any answers on those White House press conferences anyway. You know, real reporters do their digging and do their reporting away from the press conferences. That you don't expect to break any big stories or come up with any new information, that shocking new information coming out of those press briefings.
All right. Well, I want to shift gears and bring it a little closer to home, up to the Merrimack Valley. Winter weather is there, and there's this slow process of returning gas service to residents and businesses following the natural gas explosions this past September that caused dozens of buildings to burn. It led to the death of one young man. More than 4,000 customers still have no gas, and for many that means no heat, no hot water. The National Transportation Safety Board issued safety recommendations to the state and Columbia Gas, saying the company could have easily prevented this catastrophe. Mariama, what are you seeing that has happened up there that still needs to happen?
Well, on one hand, I just think this is you know, a travesty. I mean, it's unconscionable that it happened in the first place. And then, you know, the fact that we're months away and people don't have it.
And that the cold weather's here.
The cold weather's here. We've had our first snow. Yeah. We're about to head into Thanksgiving. I mean, I can't even imagine how families are figuring out how to make this all work during this season. So that's, you know, challenging. I've seen stories about small business owners, you know, folks who launched their business maybe a couple months before this. And those businesses may never recover because they've completely lost momentum at this point.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, on the human toll, this is really, really challenging. I think on the other side, it leads to some questions, not just here, but I'm listening about what's going on with electrical lines in California, and it's making me ask, you know, sort of as a citizen, are we properly regulating, you know, gas and electric and all of these services? Because you're right. Every day we, you know, turn on the stove or we turn on the light and we expect everything to go well. But when it doesn't go well, it can go very wrong, deadly wrong. So, you know, I'm hoping that there's some deeper digging to figure out what exactly is wrong, because it seems like it should not be taking this long to get everything back in line.
Well, speaking of the human toll, yesterday on the show we heard from Carmen Vega in Lawrence. She's a program coordinator and mental health clinician who's been helping families struggling with this crisis. She told us also about her struggles, her family's, that she literally has trouble sleeping at night, worried about her safety. Here's what she said.
It would be awesome to be back to what our normal was, which were when we turn on the faucet, it's we can have an option of cold or hot. But now I'm even thinking, you know, when we do have heat and hot water, it's like, are we safe? Is there going to be another explosion? Is there going to be gas leak?
Yeah, I mean, you can't blame her for having those fears. Joe, what's your reaction about
that? No, I don't blame her at all for having that. I can't imagine. I have gas myself, and I don't live up there. But still, it makes you wonder how safe it is. And I do think that the utilities need more oversight in general. In general, the big utilities have been pretty cozy with Beacon Hill lawmakers. They give them tons of campaign donations up there. And I'm not sure if that's had an effect or not, but Columbia Gas seems to be covering their rear ends, spend most of their time doing that. And I'm not sure how much of their time is spent on PR as opposed to actually getting the job done. I would like to see less PR and more getting the work done.
Yeah, I was really struck. We were all struck at the program here about these safety recommendations from the NTSB. There were a whole bunch of recommendations, among them to keep better construction records and make them available to workers, because the NTSB found that an engineer on site at the time of the disaster didn't have access to records and had limited knowledge of the system's sensing line, which wasn't properly installed and caused that overpressurization. But doesn't this seem like sort of obvious stuff that should have already been in place?
Well,
I mean, it included licensing. I mean, one of the urgent recommendations: require engineers on gas projects to have licenses. Really? I mean, why wasn't that in place already? I don't get it.
Well, I mean, for me, I've really been baffled. I mean, I can't understand why this is taking so long. Another report I read said, you know, that we have all these national grid workers who haven't been working. Why aren't they working? Like, it just seems like it should not take this long. And at some point, when you have a situation that's spinning out of control as this is, it's time for major reform to happen. So I know that, you know, Beacon Hill is out of session right now, but I'll have to say, as a citizen, I think many of us have an expectation that when our lawmakers come back into session, a systemic and deep fix needs to be in order. And as Joe mentioned, I have seen how deeply the utilities are embedded on Beacon Hill. You know, it is what it is. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, when people's lives are at risk, people's livelihoods and businesses and homes are unusable, something has to be done. And I think that's you know, I expect something to happen at Beacon Hill.
Joe, do you think Beacon Hill lawmakers are up to doing something substantive in response to this?
Not necessarily. I mean, even though they are out of session, but they could easily come back into session in an emergency like this and hold hearings. I know the U.S. Senate is going to be holding, I think, its first hearing at the end of the month, and Elizabeth Warren leading that, as well as Ed Markey. And so, you know, they seem to be acting quicker than lawmakers on Beacon Hill on this. And, you know, there needs to be a sense of urgency from lawmakers that we need to get these things done. And, reading those NTSB findings, I was struck by the same thing as you, Anthony. It's like, they don't have licenses?
Yeah.
I mean, shouldn't they have licenses?
It's really bizarre. Well, let's move on before we run out of time. One more local topic. The lots of reaction this week to Amazon's decision that it's HQ2. It's not coming to Boston. The company officially announced this week it'll split its 50,000 new jobs and headquarters between New York and Northern Virginia. Boston, together with Somerville, was among 20 HQ2 finalists named earlier this year. And Mayor Marty Walsh told reporters this week it's Amazon's loss.
You know, I'm happy of us being in the running. You know, we started with 232 different cities and towns across America. We made it to the final. You know, I think Amazon might have missed an opportunity here in Boston because we have the talent and the talent in our city and the growth in our city that could work with them.
So, Joe, did Amazon miss the opportunity, or did Boston dodge a bullet? What's your view?
No, I think that it's interesting that when Amazon was looking to come up here, or you know, in that phony contest that they had, when it was in fact already pretty much decided where they were going to go, it was ridiculous in the first place. And you know, at least we didn't throw out billions of dollars of incentives for them to come here. We did. We did have some tax incentives and some packages of aid for Amazon. But I think that it's interesting that when they were coming here, Amazon, or the possibility of coming here, everyone was like, oh, we have to get Amazon. This is great for Boston, great for Massachusetts. And then as soon as Amazon makes their decision, it's like, oh, we don't need them anyway. You know, you can't have it both ways. It's a very typical Massachusetts reaction.
It's a long tradition of sour grapes.
Yes,
what do you mean?
I know.
Mariama, what do you see?
Well, you know, I have to be honest. I was ambivalent about it. Anywhere they went, it seemed like, you know, lots of traffic and, you know, but I think at the end of the day, what I do hope, and I'm not sure will happen, is that we can actually ask some tough questions about what things may have needed to be strengthened in terms of particularly our transportation infrastructure, which is in, it's in real need. You know, we have the oldest subway system. That's great. Love the history. But the screeching on the Green Line gets me a little worried every time. You know, our education system. So I hope that the things that we thought about in terms of making our bid strong become things that we continue to focus on in terms of making our city strong. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes the glossy thing sort of motivates us in a way that the everyday doesn't focus us quite as well.
It's interesting. We heard that in October from Boston's economic development chief, John Barrows, who said the city would have been forced to fix transit and housing and other major issues if it had won the Amazon headquarters.
Yeah, housing, of course, is a major thing for us to be talking about.
But I don't know. Joe, does this at least remind us that these are things we got to take care of, with or without Amazon?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I don't think we could have handled 50,000 people or even 25,000 people that they split it in two. Would have been a stretch for traffic alone. You know, just think about the traffic that coming in on 93 anyway every day, and handling thousands of new cars. You know, the roads wouldn't have been able to handle it, and certainly the T would not have been able to handle it. But I don't even think those were issues that mattered to Amazon. I think this decision was made ahead of time anyway, because look at New York doesn't have the greatest subway system either.
Yeah.
There's plenty of screeching going on in the subway there, if you've ever been down there. There's plenty of traffic in Washington, D.C. area too. So I don't think we would have gotten this no matter what bid we would have put out.
Well, they offered billions in subsidies that Boston didn't want to go near. I mean, that certainly had a lot to do with it, too.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm actually proud of us that we didn't. I don't think giving tons of money and then also having to do all this infrastructure upgrade makes sense. So, you know, it could have been good, and it would have, you know, been a job provider for some folks. But it, at the end of the day, I guess as a Bostonian, I'm not shedding any tears.
All right. So HQ2 goes the way of Boston's Olympic bid.
Exactly.
Could have been, but it's not going to be.
Another loss for Marty Walsh, by the way.
Interesting. All right. Listen, we've got to sort of begin to shut this down. We've got just enough time left for our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention but didn't rise above that fold. Mariama, what's your hubbub?
Well, a couple weeks ago, Anthropocene magazine started talking about the need to bring more big mammals back, and one of them that they suggested was reindeer. So as we head into the Christmas season, I was thinking they were saying that reindeer can be helpful in reducing shrubs and actually protecting forests, and given what we've seen in California, I want to make a pitch for the reindeer. We need to bring them back, and maybe they can be part of addressing the concerns that President Trump has about how well America is doing in fighting forest fires.
All right. Reindeer. That's such a nice idea. As Christmas is now just around
the
corner.
Who knows? They
I
may
like
be able
that.
To fly from place to place. Help
like Joe, what's
I
yours?
Also have a holiday-related hubbub and an animal-related hubbub, too. It's the next big thing in Thanksgiving. Turkeys is turkey trackers. There's a company that actually has, at least one company, that has now put trackers on their turkeys. So you can scan it, and it lets you know like what particular farm they came from and what the farm was like. And, you know, it's so if you want to get up close and personal with the animal that you're about to eat, I think turkey trackers are the way to go. But, you know, they, as far as I know, they don't they're not getting into like what the turkey was named or anything like that, which is a good thing, I think.
All right, good. All right, well, here's my hubbub. More reasons to cheer the Red Sox. We're going to be talking a little bit about this later in the hour. But as we know, Mookie Betts won the American League MVP. Hooray. We won the World Series. Hooray. And it's all sort of one more reason that the Red Sox have to raise ticket prices again. This was sort of the smaller story. You know, these big yay Mookie Betts. And by the way, the Red Sox, which already have the highest average ticket prices in the American League at about $57 a ticket, is jacking that price up by 2.5%. So I guess we need to think about that as sort of the World Series tax, right? If you want to win the World Series, you just have to pay more to come and see this team. All right, Joe Battenfeld, political columnist of the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks, Joe. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Reverend Maryama White Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Maryama, have a great weekend. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, stay with us, folks. There's more ahead. Coming up, we'll take a look at the FDA's plans to restrict sales of flavored e-cigarettes and to ban menthol cigarettes. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.